Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be talking with Dr. Bruce Lipton. We're going to be talking about the relationship really between trauma and sleep and how what happens in our bodies and our consciousness as a result of traumatic experiences can impact our nervous system, but also impact sleep. We're also going to talk later in the interview around actually the power of sleep as a way to help change some of these impacts that trauma can have. So to give you a little bit of Bruce Lipton's background, Bruce Lipton, PhD, cell biologist and lecturer, is an internationally recognized leader in bridging science and spirit. Bruce was on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and later performed groundbreaking stem cell research at Stanford University. He's the best-selling author of The Biology of Belief, The Honeymoon Effect, and co-author of Spontaneous Evolution. Bruce received the 2009 prestigious Goi Peace Award in Japan in honor of his scientific contribution to world harmony. So welcome, Bruce. I'm super excited to be having this conversation with you. As I was saying, just before we started recording, I came across a video on YouTube where you were talking about sleep, what I would call effectively the gift of sleep, and how that movement into sleep and that movement out of sleep actually offers a real gateway to have an impact on our subconscious. And I'd love to start there, because I think so much of the conversation we're having in this conference around sleep is how to fix it and how to deal with the problems. But of course, it has so much to offer us as well.
Yes. Well, you're not going to do it without sleep. And the most important aspect about sleep is that it gives a chance for the body to recalibrate its system. So when consciousness is out, then the body starts to balance everything that's going on, you know, with each system, the body's pH, the temperature regulation. Very interesting point that when people are comatose and they're in a hospital and they got all the wires on them and everything, they run at a beautiful, just beautiful, like idling speed. They're comatose, but their body has maintained a balance and harmony and everything is great in the body level. But as soon as they become awake, then the parameters in the body all start to change because it's our consciousness that is creating the functions of our body. And it's really important for people to understand this is that quantum physics is the most valid science on this planet in regard to its theoretical insights. And the number one principle in quantum physics is consciousness is creating our life experience. That's the most important understanding. Because it says we're not just a machine, but we're like a remote control machine. There's an energy field that is being picked up by each of us that is different. The field that's being received is different for each person. I knew this when I was cloning stem cells. One of the most important things is this: why can't we exchange cells and organs with each other? You know, Alex, you put a kidney in my body and my immune system will say not self and reject it. You know, I put a lung in your body and your immune system goes not self, reject it. Well, one of the things that got to me as a cell biologist is obviously there's identity that makes us different from each other and that our immune systems can read that identity. So I started to say, so where is this identity localized in the cell? And it turned out on the surface of our cells are protein antennas. They're called receptors. The surface of our skin, we have receptors, eyes, ears, nose, teeth. Receptors read environmental signals and then accommodate the changes in the body to stay alive. Well, what's important about this set of receptors that I was talking about is that no two people have the same set of receptors, what are called self receptors, which right away is like self receptors. Well, in the old days, they thought it was just the antennas that made us different from each other. But with our understanding now of physics is that the antennas are receivers. And I go, yeah, but so you have an identity set of receptors different than mine, different than anybody else's on the planet. Everybody out there has their own unique set of receptors. I go, so, okay, so that gives us personal identity. But I go, but what does it represent? And this is the part that blew my mind was their antennas. that pick up a signal, and the receptors are on the outside of the cell, which automatically says wherever the signal is coming from, it's not inside the cell, and that each of us is receiving an environmental signal that is unique to us and different to everybody else. And these become very important, because then I say, well, then my identity is not the antennas. My identity is the signal picked up by the antennas. And then when I was looking at this back then, you know, I wasn't a spiritual person at all. I was truly just a science guy, DNA, protein, cells, you know, mechanism. You're born, you live, you die, the cells go back into pieces. That was it. But once I started to understand the nature of these self receptors, I started to recognize that our identity is being picked up through these receptors, and no two people share the same receptors. And your cells have these antennas on them. A very interesting experiment by a friend of mine took a person's cells, Brian O'Leary, an astronaut, took his cells from his body, some cells, put them in a test tube, and had that test tube 350 miles away from where he was. So Brian O'Leary's over here. A test tube with the cells are over here, 350 miles away. They do the experiment pretty neat. They have a split screen television where they have a picture live of Brian O'Leary on one side, and on the other side, the electrical readout of the cells 350 miles away. Okay, so here's the thing that was blow away. If Brian O'Leary had an emotional response instantaneously, 350 miles away, his cells started all getting all activated. So I said, well, wait a minute. What does this represent? And the answer is this. Our identity is a broadcast. And the broadcast is more or less global. So if I separate my cells, because all my cells have antennas to my broadcast, and I move my cells 350 miles away, if I'm having an emotional response, the same information is being picked up by the cells 350 miles away, which says, well, how can that happen? And I say, because our identity is not in here. Our identity is out here. Well, this blew me away, because I wasn't a spiritual person, but all of a sudden I says, oh my God, I can't die. Why? I'm not even in here. I'm the broadcast that's coming here. And all of a sudden it was like, the analogy is like we're television sets. I'm playing the Bruce Show. Why? That's the broadcast coming to my television, and it's playing on the screen called the body. And then I go, but if you're watching a TV and it breaks, we say the TV's dead. And I go, yeah, absolutely. Why? It's not playing the broadcast anymore. Question, the TV died, but did the broadcast die? I go, no, broadcast is always there. Why? Get another TV, plug it in, turn it on. And when you tune it to the right broadcast signal, it's the show's back on. I go, oh my God, two things I learned instantaneously. A, I can't die because I'm not in here. I'm the television set you're looking at right now. And B is that if I do pass on, my television is done, and a future embryo shows up with the same set of antennas, I'm back in a different TV. Now, this comes to the really cool part, because it says, well, does it make a difference if it's a male or female TV? I go, no, that's the TV. We are the broadcast. Does it make a difference if you're a white, brown, black, red, yellow TV? I go, no, that's the TV. You're the broadcast. And all of a sudden, it's like all my life changed, because I realized that I have this experience on this planet. Now, I'm a science guy. So once I said, oh, my God, I am. My identity is this broadcast, a spirit, an energy field in physics, okay? And I go, well, that's really cool. And then I started to recognize, of course, that this being the television set is not actually a broadcast. And then I also asked myself a question, and this is where the fun part comes into my life, because I asked a question, simple question as a science guy. I said, well, I can see that I'm a spiritual entity, and I have here a physical expression, body. I said, to myself, why have both a body and a spirit? Why not just be the spirit? And this is, I always laugh, because I always say, this is when I found out I had Jewish comedian cells, because I asked a question and then 50 trillion cells welled up with an answer, but in the form of a question, I asked, why have both a spirit and a body? And the cells, the thought just came into my head from the cells. And the cells said, if you're just a spirit, Bruce, what does chocolate taste like? And all of a sudden I said, oh.
That's a good go on, hey?
the whole idea is what? A spirit is awareness, but a body translates awareness into sensation. I can see, I can smell, I can taste, I can hear, I can feel. I can feel what love is. I can feel what pain is. I can all of a sudden I go, this is not available to the spirit, but it's like used by the spirit. Because let's just say it was a spiritual entity and you and I are talking and say, let's describe love. And then we describe love with all the wonderful words you want to describe. But I say, but if you never felt love, then your definition is incomplete, totally incomplete. I say, well, what does love feel like? I say, first you have to have a body, and the body will manifest a sensation and then turn it into an energy broadcast back to self. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, we came here to experience life. That's why we have all these receptors, you know? And the beautiful part is we also came here to create life. Because we're creating it. And this is what quantum physics is saying anyway. And now biology, my research revealed epigenetics is the science of how consciousness is creating our genetic activity. And so physics and biology come together saying, we're creating this. And it became really important because then I understood that I came here to have all these experiences. Well, now, in regard to the work that you're so significantly involved with, Alex, is not all of our experiences are great experiences. Some of our experiences are very life-threatening experiences. And I go, so significance is this. My cells revealed, and this is a very important piece of an experiment that shows something. I put cells in a Petri dish. If I put food in the Petri dish, the cells all go to the food. But if I put toxins, threatening chemistry in the Petri dish, the cells move away from the threat. And when they go to a stimulus like food or love or something like that, the good ones, we go open and we take it in, assimilate, grow, whether it's nourishment or love, you're taking it in. So growth is go to the signal, open yourself up and take it in. In contrast, protection is to go away from the signal and close yourself down to ward off the threat. So I said, guess what? You can't be in growth and protection at the same time. Why? Growth, go to it, protection, go away from it. Growth, stay open, protection, stay closed. You can't be open and closed at the same time. You can't go to something and away from it at the same time. It's like, so we're either in growth or in protection. Now, I'm going to bring in something that maybe the community hasn't really listened to or heard before, something called the biological imperative. What the hell is the biological imperative? I go, the most primitive organism to the most advanced organism is endowed with what is called biological imperative. And I go, what is that? The drive to survive. Biological imperative. It has two levels to it. One, survival of you as an entity, and two, survival of the species as a community. So it's built into our system, and it's a very important device, because if we become threatened, the biological imperative will engage the functions of the system to put you in a protection mode, which is what? Close it down, move away, hide out, be over here. And I go, that's what you do. I say, okay, now the problem with trauma, and this is your whole thing going on here, and it comes like this. Trauma is a threat to your survival. So the biological imperative, when you get traumatized, the biological imperative kicks right in and says, okay, recognize what's going on here because you don't want to do this again. That's what the imperative says. What were the things that were there that precipitated that threat? Because now it's going to, in a structure in the brain called the amygdala, it's got a scanning system. It's going to look around and say, if anything out there that was relevant to that threat shows up, I'm going to be informed, because I'm going to learn from that experience. So if it all shows up again, I'm ready to deal with it. Okay. So I say, this is great. This keeps you alive. But now comes a problem. And it comes like this, is that when you have the trauma, you have a whole physiological consequence. The brain releases all kinds of protection chemistry, stress hormones, things that affect the immune system. Why? To get you in protection. Okay? And that was a learning experience. But if you hold on to that trauma, then you've made a mistake. I go, what do you mean? I say, good to learn about the experience, but then let it go. Because if you don't let it go, it's always there. And now your whole life is what? Now I'm in protection all the time. I go, this completely, you can't stay in protection. You can't stay closed. Reminds me in the US, we had air raid shelters when we thought the Russians were going to bomb us. I say, great, you know what? You go, you're working, beautiful day. Every business is open, schools are, everything. It's growing community. Air raid siren goes off. It's a test. I say, so what do? We leave the job. We leave the school. We leave all these things. We go down into a hole in the ground. Protection. That's what the bomb shelter is about. I go, great. Now I'm in the bomb shelter and I'm waiting for what? All clear. So 10, 15 minutes after the test siren, you get all clear. And then you come out and you go back to work. No problem. But logically, what if you get the air raid signal? You go into the bomb shelter, but there's no all clear. What would be the consequence? You will die. Why? There's only so much food. There's only so much water. There's only so much air. And if you stay there too long, closed in, you know, protection, closed off, you will die. You can't stay in protection. You have to open it up. You have to grow. You have to breathe. You have to eat. You have to be engaged. You got to do it. So if you stay in protection, you are going downhill toward death.
And I think the point you're making, which is really, really important here, is often people think about trauma as being the event or the events that happened. And I think the point you're making is that the real impact is what changes in our nervous system and what changes in our various bodily systems in response to that. And then that becomes the real trauma, that we're now responding in an unhealthy way to things which are not a threat.
Yeah. I love this little story. It's a story about two Buddhist monks walking along a trail. Now, Buddhist monks are not allowed to touch women. That's forbidden. Okay. And they're walking along and they come to a river and there's a woman all dressed up in her wedding finery. And she's crying. She's saying, I can't get to my wedding. If I go across the water, I'm going to ruin all my clothes, blah, blah, blah. So one of the monks just picks her up, carries her across, drops her off on the other side, and the two monks keep walking. An hour later, the monk that didn't pick up the woman looks at the one that did and said, you touched the woman. You picked up a woman. And the one who picked up the woman says to the other one, he says, I dropped her off an hour ago and you're still carrying her. Okay. Well, this replies to trauma. The trauma was the event. It was an awareness. It was a learning experience. The point about it is once you have the experience, I don't have to carry the experience with me ever after that, because now I got a learning. Why? If the events that led to that start to show up again, my memory and my protection system, my adrenal system, will get me ready to deal with it. But if I keep it on my mind day and night, then I'm in protection. And I go, well, what's the result? And I said, you can't stay in protection. That will kill you. You're closing yourself down. You have to let go. It doesn't mean I forget about it. Absolutely not. No, I had a trauma event. I'm going to remember. But do I have to carry it with me every day? And the answer is no. As a matter of fact, by carrying it with you every day, then you're not letting go of the protection which separates you from life. And this is where trauma has the most negative consequences. I can get sick and die from just the trauma, from the experience of it. It's happening anymore, but the memory of it. If I keep it alive every day, every moment, and live in trauma, then I'm not open to surviving on this planet at all. And the really important part about this is the sleep. And I say, why was this relevant? And I go, it's a machine. This body is a machine. It's got all kinds of systems in there, and everything is regulated by the chemistry, and there, and it has to clean itself up, and it has to take, it has to be serviced. You have a vehicle, you never service it, it's not going to last that long. You service a vehicle. I go, sleep is servicing the biological vehicle, because while you're unconscious, just like I said, the people in are in a coma, while you're unconscious, the system can adjust and take care and clean up the chemistry and, you know, take care of toxins and refeed the system and do all that. That's what sleep is for. You need the sleep.
And of course, part of the challenge is that when we have that trauma, we have that overload in our system, in a sense, sleep is an act of surrender, right? Sleep is a place where we go from being wired and holding on in our life to actually surrendering. And that can be difficult when we have that activation and that trauma response.
Yeah. Well, as I said, in the brain, there's a center called the amygdala, which holds on to all these trauma things like that. And I go, significance is this, I'm trying to go to sleep. And I go, yeah, but listen, in the soundest of sleep, a noise could happen and you'll be ready to go. Why? It's working 24/7. It's working all the time. It's fearing, look, if I go to sleep, that threat will get me when I'm sleeping. And so at some point, the trauma interferes with the sleep because it says, I can't let go. I got to be observant. I got to be on guard. I have to be a watch. And as a result, you collapse at some point. It's not sleeping. That point is collapsing at some point because you can't maintain this. It's not, as I said, you can't maintain chronic protection. It doesn't work. Now, yes. And the important part about this is I say, you don't forget the trauma. No, but you don't have to hold it because the system now has a memory of it. And if any of the circumstances show up that were associated with that trauma, re-show up, your memory system will bring back a need for protection. If those stimuli don't show up, I don't need the protection. If the stimuli do show up, I'm prepared for it. But those people that carry the trauma, it's like carrying that woman across and forgetting that that happened a while ago and I dropped her off and I'm still carrying her in my mind. And it's like, that's chronic. That's a problem. That's staying in a bomb shelter too long. You cannot survive in that bomb shelter.
Yes. Now, and, of course, we can recognize that the people watching this that will be going, that's me. I'm still carrying the woman, or I'm still stuck in the bomb shelter. You've spoken a lot in your work about the capacity that we all have to impact and transform what's happening, not just on a conscious level, but on a subconscious level, those programs and those learnings. So let's speak a little bit. So if someone has this recognition that they've had whatever these experiences may be, and through that, they've programmed a response that they now recognize needs to be changed. Let's speak to how that can happen.
Well, the first thing we have to understand is this. When we say the mind is controlling our biology, and I go, yeah, the mind does that. And the misleading word is the mind. I go, why is that misleading? I say, because there's more than one mind. There's two minds. And they're interdependent. They work together. You need both, okay? I say, what's the two minds? I say, well, the latest evolution is called the conscious creative mind. That's the one connected to you as your spirit, your individuality. No two people share the same creative conscious mind. That's connected to your personal identity. The subconscious mind is the equivalent of a hard drive in a computer. In fact, that's exactly what it is. I go, relevance. Let's just take the analogy of the computer. This is very critical here. And I go, in the old days, when you'd go buy a computer, you could bring it home and then you could push the start button and the screen lights up. It's called booting up. It's ready to go. I say, oh, you brought a brand new computer. It's booted up. It's ready to go. I say, now do something. Surf the web. You know, write an essay. Make a drawing. And you go, I can't do it. I say, you got a brand new computer. You say, not until I put programs in the computer can I use the computer. So I go, oh, guess what? The human brain computer boots up in the last trimester of pregnancy, the last 3 months of development. But it can't work until you put programs in it. So it starts downloading experiences as programs. You watch your mother, you watch your father, siblings, or community. You watch their behavior in the first 7 years. And you're not just watching it. In the first 7 years, your brain is in a state called theta, which is hypnosis. I go, so what's the relevance? I watch my father. I watch his behavior. But guess what? I just downloaded his behavior. I have a program. It's in my subconscious. That's how my father behaves. That's how my mother behaves. That's how the community behaves. I download them. No consciousness. Consciousness doesn't even really kick in full time until after age 7. So I go, so the first 7 years, the last trimester of pregnancy, the computer screen boots up. Consciousness is ready to go, but no program. So for 7 years, you take your life experiences and you make programs out of them. And then after age 7, you become more conscious. And now you can use the keyboard, which is separate from the hard drive. The hard drive got the program, but the keyboard, I put data into the machine. So consciousness is me using the keyboard where I can put in what I want, wishes, desires, whatever I want, okay? And now comes the whole problem. The problem is this. The conscious mind, which can, you know, you can create every day from the conscious mind. You can create wishes and desires and all this stuff I'll talk about in a second. But I say, but the conscious mind can also think. And I'll say, what the hell does that mean? I say, when you're not thinking, the conscious mind is looking out your eyes, out the window. Like, imagine your body is a vehicle and you got a steering wheel. And when the conscious mind is driving, it's looking out the windshield and driving you to what? Wishes and desires. That's what conscious mind's all about. But the moment the conscious mind is thinking, it's no longer looking out the window for a reason, is thinking is inside. Okay, Alex, today is a Tuesday recording day right here. But I say, Alex, tell me what you're doing on Thursday. It may not be written anywhere in front of you, but in a moment you'll say, oh, Thursday I'm, and I go, where'd you get that? Oh, I went inside and I thought about it. And I go, the moment you went inside with a conscious mind, that means it's not looking out the window. So the moment you're thinking, conscious mind is involved inside. It's not controlling your behavior. I go, what if you're driving the car and you have a thought? And I go, guess what? The conscious mind is not paying attention anymore. And I go, don't worry, because the subconscious mind knows how to drive the vehicle. It's a program. You learned it. So the moment the conscious mind is thinking, the subconscious mind takes over the control. And I go, okay, walking, I don't need to think about that. Talking, I don't need. These are programs. I know how to do these things with my subconscious. Now comes the monkey wrench of all, Alex, and it is this. How much time are we thinking? And it turns out average time, 95% of the day. Now stop and think of the mathematics. That means only 5% of the day am I driving the vehicle to where I want to go. And 95% of the day, the programs I downloaded are driving me to where the programs want me to go. Did I select the programs? I say, no, you downloaded them. And the conscious mind wasn't filtering. There was no conscious mind to say, good program, bad program. No, it just downloaded whatever you saw. And it turns out up to 60% of those programs are disempowering or self-sabotaging downloads. So I go, well, then 95% of the day, you're actually operating from those programs. I go, do you see your behavior? I go, no. I go, why not? Because your conscious mind is looking inside. It doesn't even see what you're doing. And I go, so relevance is this. If my subconscious has got programs that are not supporting me, then 95% of the day, I will be sabotaging myself with behaviors that come from the subconscious that in no way take me to wishes and desires. And then all of a sudden I started to see a victim attitude. I wanted to be happy and successful and healthy, and it's not working. And then because you're unaware that you were even involved, why? Conscious mind was inside. You didn't see whatever behavior you played. Then there's a tendency for all of us, and here's the connection problem. We believe we are victims. The world out there is threatening me. And this is causing a problem. This person caused a problem, not a problem. All of a sudden I go, we feel victim, and victim is powerless by definition. Victim means I have no power, okay? And if we have negative programs and they're playing 95% of the day and we don't see them, what would be the consequence? So I give this story like 40 years because I'm still looking for a better one, but it's a good one right now. You have a friend, you know your friend's behavior very well, and you happen to know your friend's parent. And one day you see your friend has the exact same behavior as the parents. So you just got to tell, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. Back away from Bill. I know exactly what Bill's going to say. I know it. And you've heard it, because Bill's going to say, how can you compare me to my dad? I'm nothing like my dad. And people laugh because they experience. I said, okay, Alex, this is the most profound story in the world. I say, why? Everybody else can see that Alex behaves like his dad. I say, where does he get that behavior? He downloaded it in the first 7 years. It's in his subconscious. Why is he playing this behavior? Because he's thinking. And so with the behavior he's playing is not him. He's just replaying his father. Okay. And the point is, he's the only one that can't see it. Why? Because he's thinking, so the conscious mind's not observing it, but everybody else is observing it. And they're responding to that negative program. And that negative program could challenge you in so many different ways, and you're the only one who can't see it. Why? We are all Bill. Every one of us is doing this every day. And the trauma becomes the biggest issue, because anything that activates the biological imperative is something that overrides all other behavior. The biological imperative is the one that says stay alive. Bacteria have a biological imperative. What do you mean? I say, try and kill a bacteria. You think it's just going to go, oh, okay, kill me? No. Bacterium will, even the most primitive organism, will do every maneuver capable to avoid dying. So the biological imperative is at the most simple level, and there's no big brain there. So all of a sudden it says, well, how does it work? And I said, biologists don't really even know how it works, but it works. Why? Try to kill something and it will resist dying with every ability it could offer to do this. So now a person gets traumatized. And if it's a serious trauma, then not only did they just have that experience, but that trauma becomes part of a program. Because that was so biological imperative significance, part of a program. And I go, then what? And I go, 95% of the day it's playing, whether you're paying attention or you're not paying attention, that trauma is running the show. What does it do? Releases stress hormones, getting you ready for fight or flight. It shuts down the immune system. It shuts down the growth. It even makes you less intelligent because of the blood flow that has changed when the stress hormones are in the body. And I go, so significance, I say, that's the person carrying that woman after they actually let it down, but in their mind, they're carrying it and they carry it. And I go, what is the important part? It activates the amygdala. What's that one? Be aware, be looking. It's going to happen. And we know it happened, and we're going to make sure it doesn't happen because we're going to keep our attention on it. And I go, well, there's your problem. If you keep your attention on the trauma, what do you think you will see through your eyes? Anything that will activate the trauma, because that's the only thing you're looking for. And all of a sudden I say, what does that do? Growth. I said, growth and protection are opposite. When there are no stress hormones in the system, we're in a state of growth, where we take food, nourishment, love, things like that, bring it in the system and thrive. But the moment we're under threat, the stress hormones come in and they shut down the growth of the body. Why? What was the purpose of the stress hormone? To run away from the saber-toothed tiger. That was where the stress was 100,000 years ago. And I go, what was its job? Prepare the body to fight or flight. I go, what does that mean? I say, you want the energy of the body to be in your arms and legs, because that's going to carry you from that threat. I go, so how does that work? And here's from a physiology book. I'll give a statement. When threat hormones are released into the system, the blood is preferentially sent to the arms and legs. I said, what the hell does that mean? The blood is the source of energy. If I'm being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, I want all the blood in my arms and legs, because those are the structures that are going to get me out of my concern. So I go, oh. So what happens is stress hormones shut down the organs in the gut, the viscera, lungs and stomach and pancreas and kidneys and all these things. I say, why? Because the energy to maintain the body, if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you can hold off on that energy because you want to use it in your arms and legs so you can run away. That's the whole reason. Okay. Yes. So I'm conserving energy. How does it work? Stress hormones go in, squeeze the blood vessels in the stomach and the gut and tighten the blood flow. Why? Because now when the blood is pushed, it's not going into the gut. It's going to the arms and legs. That's where I need the blood. Okay. So I shut down growth. First thing, stress hormone, shut down growth. Number two, the immune system protects me from an internal threat. Okay. And it uses a lot of energy because if you're really sick, you can't even get out of bed. You don't have so much energy. So I say, yeah, but if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger and you have a bacterial infection, how would you want to split the energy? I go, the hell with the bacteria. If the tiger eats you, the bacteria is not your problem anymore.
But so, it might be the tiger's problem.
You betcha. That's where it goes. It's like, give it to them. But the problem is you, at the cost of your life. So the point about it is simply this. Stress hormones shut off the immune system. Okay, so that's two problems right away. Growth maintenance, shut off by blood vessels squeezing shut. Immune system, stress hormones directly inhibit the immune system, so I'm not putting energy in to internal problem when I'm being chased. And then I always call the third one the insult to the injury. You just injured your body. Now you will know what the insult is. I told you the stress hormones in the gut squeeze shut when you're in fear. That's a butterflies in the stomach. You can feel it. It's just queasy, queasy. And I go, what else? The stress hormones shut the blood vessels off in the thinking brain back right here, the prefrontal cortex. And when the blood is squeezed, the blood vessels are squeezed shut here, the blood is pushed to the hind brain. That's where reflexes occur and reactions occur. No thinking. So guess what? Under stress, you shut down thinking and now you're just reacting. And I go, so you lost the power of your consciousness. It's not working. Those are the three consequences. Now, the fear is what keeps you there.
Yeah. Sorry, finish that. And then I was going to ask, how do we then start to shift it? Because that's the really exciting
part. Oh, that's the most important part that I never talked about, because I was the biology guy and it always irritated me because I explained all the mechanisms, how that consciousness created all of this response. And always the first question was, well, how do I change that? And I go, but now I know. And I know because I met a friend who does what is called energy psychology, which is a new version of psychology. It's a super learning technique. And I was just finishing my lecture. And of course, the first question, how do you change it? And I go, nobody give a damn about the beautiful science, about how it all works. They just wanted to change it. And I was sort of like, and I'd walk to the back of the room after saying, no, I don't know how to change it. So the next guy up says, I'm going to show you how to change it. And I go, ooh, he's going to show me in this class, in this, this conference room, he's going to change somebody's belief in front of us. I thought, I'm going to watch this. And I watched and I saw he asked, who wants to change a belief? Everybody's hands went up. Everybody wanted to change something. But one woman was like this. She was actually going like that. And I saw her. He saw her. And my friend Rob brings her up on the stage and says, he first asked her in the audience, what is it you want to change? And tell us your name and what you want to change. And everybody looked at her and she just turned red, like a red light bulb. She couldn't say her name. She could say nothing. So Rob goes into the audience and it's next to her and asks her, so what do you want to change? She says, I can't talk in public. Well, this is pretty damn obvious. Her name's Pauline. She can't talk in public. So he brings her up on the stage. He goes through a process they call a balance, which is one of the many different ways of energy psychology. And it engages a super learning experience where you can rewrite a program and 5 minutes, 7 minutes, something you had your entire life. This is why it's the miracle for me, because my life was radically changed by this kind of process as well. And all I'll never, never forget, she was doing this balance process where she's sitting in a chair and rewriting. And then when she got finished, she stood up on the stage and Rob put his arm around her shoulder and faced her to the audience and said, Pauline, would you like to describe to the audience what you just experienced? He took his arm off and she started walking up and down the stage, telling a life story and this story and that story. And Rob's there going, Pauline, please sit down. You're using my lecture time. She couldn't say her name. And 10 minutes later, he had to ask her to shut up. And that was one of the ways. Okay, so let me tell you, there are three ways to change a program. How do you know what the program is? First thing is this. 95% of your life is coming from the subconscious. That's a fact. So I say, then your life is a printout of your programs. You have no memory of these programs, many of them. Why? You were being programmed before you were born, last trimester of pregnancy. You were programmed a whole year, 0 to 1. You weren't conscious. You have no idea what the program was. You were programmed from 1 to 2. You have no idea what the program was. You weren't conscious from 2 to 3. And up after 3, you might have memories of some of these things. So I said, for the first 2 or 3 years of your life, you were programmed. You have no idea what the hell the program was. You were not there. And you didn't filter it. That's a very important one, because if there were bad programs, you downloaded those just as well as you did good programs. Why? Because there was no filtering. And 60% or so of the programs that we downloaded are disempowering, self-sabotaging, and limiting beliefs that we acquire from other people, parents, family, community, before age 7. So I go, okay. So I say, I got these programs. I say, I don't know what they are. I say, yes, you do. You know why? 95% of your life is coming from the program. That's how much the subconscious is running. So I said, then look at your life right now. And I can have you identify your program. I go, what? I say, the things that you like that come into your life, they come in because you have a program to acknowledge those things. Okay. But the things you desire and wish for and you want and you struggle and you work hard and you sweat over it, I'm making it happen. I'm gonna make it happen. I'm working really hard. Why are you working so hard? The answer, whatever that destination is, the programs you got do not support that. And that's why you put the effort in to try to override a program that's running 95% of the day. It's like, oh, okay, you got a problem mathematically. Why? The subconscious is working 95% of the day, and the subconscious is 1 million times more powerful a computer than the conscious. So right away, mathematically, you're trying to override the program. Not easy to do that. So I say, so what can I do? I said, well, how'd you get the program? First 7 years, you were in a state of hypnosis. Your brain was in a brain state. When they put wires on a person's head, they call electroencephalograph. They read the energy vibrations. And at age, up through age 7, the predominant vibration is called theta, which is imagination. And this is how kids mix real world and imaginary world seamlessly. I always suggest that famous tea party where they pour nothing into the cup. They drink the nothing, and how wonderful, that was the best tea they ever had in their life. I go, theta, imagination. Okay. But theta is hypnosis. So for the first 7 years, you are downloading behavior into your hard drive computer by observing other people. I say, you want to change the program? Then you have to do hypnosis. That's one of the ways. I go, you mean I have to see a hypnotherapist? I go, no, here's the cool part. Theta, the hypnosis state of the brain, is a vibration just below consciousness. Meaning when you go to bed at night, as long as you're conscious, you're just above theta. But the moment your eyes close and you're now unconscious, you're in theta. And that means if I put a pair of earphones on with a program telling me what I want, what I would rather have, and every night I put the program on through the earphones, the moment I fall asleep, I don't hear the program, but the subconscious is still active in theta, and it will download the program. So unfortunately, theta is not a long time period. That's why if you put the earphones on, you have to do it night after night for a number of nights. And then the subconscious will, while you're sleeping, the subconscious will be downloading new behavior. So that's one way. That's a hypnosis, self-hypnosis, earphones every night with
program. And that of course goes back to our part of our frame of this interview of the gift of sleep, that actually that movement into sleep and that movement out of sleep also is a gateway in terms of impacting and transforming some of the ways that we are meeting the world.
Absolutely. The one you can control is the one going to sleep, because you're awake. And you say, I'm going to put the earphones on because the next moment I'm going to be in theta. It's harder to come from sleep, which is a low vibration delta, go through theta and be aware that it's there until you wake up. So by the time you wake up, now you're out of theta. So you didn't really get a control. Interesting point. If you have a clock radio and it turns on while you're still sleeping, you're in theta, it will, through imagination, take whatever was on that clock radio show and through imagination, put it into a dreamlike state before you wake up. And that's how sometimes the radio goes on and then we take some of whatever was going on. All of a sudden we're having a dream that it's part of it. Why? That's imagination. That's what theta is. So number one, self-hypnosis. Go to sleep, put the earphones on just before going to sleep, put a program of what you wish and desire to be true and repeat. But after age seven, you still learn things that go into subconscious. You learn how to drive a car, learn how to play a music instrument. I say, how did you learn those behaviors? And I say, repetition, practice, habituation. Subconscious is habits. So you want to change your life, then you have to make a new habit and then practice it. Just like you didn't know how to drive a car, but you got in the car and you practiced it. And you practiced and then you drove. And guess what? Now you don't even have to think about it. You get in the car, you put the key in. You don't even think, I'm going to the store or everything. You don't even think about the details of even driving the damn car. It's automatic now.
Although it's funny, I've got a car that self-drives and a friend of mine's got the same car. And I say, if you use the self-drive, it's amazing. He's like, oh no, I wouldn't trust that. It's too scary not to be in control. And that was funny because as you were talking earlier, I was thinking, but he's not in control the whole time anyway. But there you are. It's like we have these programs that we get so normalized to and so familiar with that we're often-
And it plays when you're not paying attention. It also, most important, it plays when you're not paying attention. That's why it's playing. If you were paying attention, then you would be operating from your conscious control. But if you're thinking, you're not paying attention. So whatever is coming out, story of Bill, I didn't see my behavior. It could sabotage me. All I see is I didn't succeed. But then I, without my knowing all about this, and then I blame everybody else out there for the problem without recognizing when I wasn't paying attention, I sabotaged myself, okay? Yes. So that's the second way, habituation. There's a new agey phrase, which is kind of humorous. It says, fake it till you make it. Meaning, I'm not a happy person. I go, so what do you want to do? I say, then every day, as many times as you can, every day, as many times you can, say, I am happy. You could be miserable as a dog. I don't care. I want you to say, I am happy. I am happy. I am happy. Why? Repetition. Well, then put that, that's how you make a habit, repetition. And by repeating that, there'll be a day where you wake up and go, I'm happy without even saying I'm happy. Why? Downloaded. You wake up now 95% of the day, I am happy. And so first one, self-hypnosis, earphones on at night. Okay. Second one, habituation, practice something that you want to be true. Interesting fact. Good actors, the really good actors in Broadway shows or movies and things like that, they take on a character, but they take on a character mentally. How am I going to behave? What my character is? They create a character, then they live that character. And when they're playing in the part that in the show, they're not playing themselves. They're playing a character. Okay. Interesting point. Those characters totally influence their entire biology. So Renee Zellweger plays a diary of somebody Jones's diary or something like, I forgot the name of the movie. Okay.
Bridget Jones's diary. I think you mean
Bridget Jones's diary. And in that story, the character is 40 pounds heavier than Renee. She takes on the character. She gained 40 pounds. She plays the character. The movie, she's 40 pounds. When the movie was over, she stopped playing the character. And guess what? The 40 pounds disappeared and she went right back to her normal weight again. She created that character. Dustin Hoffman, one of the superb actors, played a very depressive character, Willie Loman in the book, Death of a Salesman. Very depressive. And he took it on and Dustin Hoffman is great. He becomes that character. He became the character so well that he had to check into a mental hospital for depression because he became Willie Loman. So it's an interesting fact. You want to be somebody else and become a character in your mind and play that character. I'm playing this character because like an actor, the more you play that character, the more your life manifests the equivalent of that character. So three ways of change. Number one, Self-hypnosis, earphones at night. Number two, habituation, repeat it is and play a role just like a character. Number three, I mentioned, was energy psychology. And there's 25 or 30 different modalities of that on my website, brucelipton.com. Look under belief change modalities. There's about 25 or 30 different ones listed with definitions and websites and all that. Energy psychology is engaging what is called super learning. The beautiful part is using these psychology programs, these modalities, you can rewrite a belief you had your whole life in matters of minutes. It's like the miracle, but we need, because human behavior is destroying the world and we're facing what is called a mass extinction because human behavior is undermining the web of life. And to survive, we have to change our behavior radically. Otherwise, extinction is coming. NASA in the United States did a survey, and they found, and this is what they published, that within the next couple of decades, civilization, industrial civilization, the one we're in, is facing, and I want to underscore like I do in a lecture, an irreversible collapse. We are going toward collapse. We're not sustainable. And that means what? We need to change our behavior. And I go, this is why this new energy psychology is amazing, because we can actually push a record button in our system and change virtually minutes later. So to go full circle around, then I go back and I say, we live our lives not from our conscious wishes and desires. The movie The Matrix, I always talk about, I say, it's not science fiction. No, the movie The Matrix is a documentary. I go, yeah, because the premise of the movie is we're all been programmed. I go, that's not a premise. That's a reality. All humans are programmed for 7 years. Then in the movie, they had a thing called the red pill. What happens? You take the red pill, you stop thinking. I go, well, what happens if you stop thinking? You stop playing the program. And all of a sudden you're in control, because when you're thinking, the program is in control 95% of the day. If you stop thinking, then you're in control. Conscious mind can control it. And I go, most everybody in our audience, Alex, out there has experienced taking the red pill at some time in their life. One of the main ones, because I wrote a book called The Honeymoon Effect, is how you could have a life, blah, 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 blah. You meet somebody, fall in love. 24 hours later, go, oh, life is so beautiful. Life is like heaven on earth. Everything is wonderful. I'm so in love. That was the red pill, folks. You stay what is called mindful when you fall in love like that. Staying mindful means you stop thinking. If you stop thinking, then you're not defaulting the program. Now you're creating from consciousness. And I go, so what happens when you fall in love? Stop thinking, you create with consciousness, and you and a partner collectively create heaven on earth. I go, heaven on earth was always here. It was only you're allowing the program by thinking so much, you allow the program to take you away from it. But the idea is, if you stop thinking, you have full control again. Go back to trauma. It was so threatening to your system that your biological imperative won't let it go. It's going to be there. And I go, but this is the point where you have to recognize, I had that experience. I don't have to keep it anymore. I'll remember that experience. It's not like, oh, forget all these experiences in your life. I said, no, those were important learning experiences. You don't want to repeat any of those things, but you don't have to have it on your mind. But that's a conscious me talking to you consciously. You don't have to have it on your mind, but your body operating subconsciously will put it on your mind, because it's a subconscious, a program. It's not you. You lost the control. When you're thinking, you lost the control. And if you start thinking about trauma, you more than lost your control, because now your trauma picture in your mind will generate the stress hormones, which will then throw a monkey wrench into the gears and mess with you.
Fantastic, Bruce. There's so many different rabbit holes we could still go down. But I want just to finish by, you mentioned it briefly a few minutes ago, but people want to find out more about you and your work. BruceLipton.com is obviously the place to go. Say a bit more about what people can find and perhaps also anything else you want to offer.
No, I mean, I have the Biology of Belief book breaks this down into an education that people can read without being medical doctors. And it gives you all the things we talked about, but it gives you the mechanism because awareness is powerful. and absent of awareness, you're a victim. Like, I have no idea what's happening. I say, but if you're aware, then you have tools to do something to work with. And your work is so vitally fundamental, Alex, because those people that are there in that community have realized they're not in control. These things are carrying them, trauma experiences are carrying them into a world they have no desire to be in. And somewhere in the back of their mind, in front of all the traumas, I don't want to be here. I go, yeah, but as long as that trauma keeps playing, your system is on alert all of the time, 24/7. I say, no, the system needs to go to sleep. And if you start to lay down and then all of a sudden the mind starts to wander into the trauma, then sleep is not happening and it's not going to be a good sleep. And you're going to physiologically pay for it. And more importantly, as quantum physics reveal, whatever that picture is in your mind, you're going to manifest it. If you have a fear, you will manifest a reason for that fear. You're a creator. I got a fear. Fear of what? Oh, that's coming to me. Yep. I created this. And people don't want to acknowledge that they're creators, because if they look back over their life and they go, I did this, I created this cancer, I created this problem, they go, I don't want to take responsibility. I go, well, that's the moment you just lost again. What happened in the past is irrelevant if you didn't understand it. What's relevant is if you understand today how it happened in the past, then you don't have to repeat the past. And the past is irrelevant, because when can I change? I say the moment you decide, I don't want this anymore, is the moment you start to have power to then start manifesting. Personal life story, very simple. If I would have been classified by a neurologist, I would have been probably called a manic depressive at some point. Why? Well, my life was really great. But then when things started to go wrong, it was a spiral and it always goes downhill. It goes downhill. And I was in a lab doing a research thing. And the setup for the experiment takes like an hour and a half of tedious measuring of chemistry and micro quantities and stuff to set it up. And then at the final stage, I take a stirring rod and I stir this chemistry up. But I got to be very careful, because if I go a little bit too fast, the heat from that, just minor heat, causes this thing to turn into plastic. So the third time that day, after spending all that time, the first time I screwed it up, turned to plastic, second time I screwed it up, third time I spent a whole day doing this. And it's like, then it did it again. I got angry and I threw this beaker with the stuff against the fume hood, and the liquid stuff was coming down and polymerizing as plastic all over the window. And I started getting mad at myself, and this is not uncommon for people. I started berating myself. You stupid idiot, you can't do anything right. You've been practicing and blah, blah, blah. You can't do blah, 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 blah. It was like the bad shoulder story criticizing me, which we all have, okay? And I was in the middle of this, and this is the beginning when I start to get depressed, because if I start criticizing myself about that, then keep that process, goes downhill and it gets worse. This particular day, I was in just getting to realize, because I knew it was coming back on. It's like, God, I hate this. It's coming. And a voice. I heard a voice. I was the only one in the room. I said, a voice. And the voice, I love it, because the voice said, don't you have anything better to do than to listen to this crap? And in that moment of consciousness, I had a choice. I said, yeah, I'd rather go see a movie. I picked up the newspaper right there, found a theater, left the lab, went to the movie, came out of the movie. No more depression. It was gone. And I laughed about it. And the next time I started to go down, all of a sudden I remembered what that, I don't need to listen to this crap. I stopped. About three or four times it started And the memory of that funny statement to me, disembodied voice, I think my spirit, the memory of that caused me to stop that conversation with myself. And guess what? I haven't been depressed for 30 plus years now, because once it starts to come in, my mind now has like a habit. The moment something like it comes in, I'm on to the next thing. Why? I don't need to dwell on it anymore.
And it goes back to what you said earlier about repetition. It's a repetition of setting up a new response, right?
Absolutely. And it was beautiful because it made me laugh when I heard about it. You know, when I looked around, I realized, okay, I'm this voice, but it was funny. It's like, you don't want to listen to this crap. I go, no. and the result about it was it eliminated, after a couple of times, the habit of that came in. So the moment if I start to think a negative thing, my habit mind will redirect me to go do something else and let go of it. I let that person down at the edge of the river. I'm not carrying that anymore. I don't care anymore about that. And it doesn't mean everything goes right for me, but when it doesn't go right, it doesn't last longer than, okay, I memorized it didn't go right. But I don't carry it for the rest of the day going, oh crap, that ruined my whole day. It's like, no. Why? Now I recognize something really important. When things don't go right, it was probably better that they didn't go the way I thought, because I wasn't thinking clearly enough that there was another way of doing it better than what I was doing. And the universe, my conscious, my spirit was going, no, don't do it this way. Yeah. So it doesn't work. In the old days, I said, but I'm going to make it work. I'm going to control it. All I did was just get myself into crap. And by the time I controlled it, I'd look back going, I didn't really want this. I go, yeah, that's what your spirit was telling you back then before you manifested what you thought you wanted.
Yeah.
And so, Alex, your work is profoundly important because the planet is in a global healthcare crisis right now. And that 90% of illness, they always say, oh, genes cause these problems. Genes cause these problems. I go, less than 1% of disease is connected to genes. Less than 1%. I mean, then where the hell is the disease coming from? Over 90% is attributed to stress. And so your work is profoundly important because we have a healthcare crisis on this planet. Do we need the healthcare crisis? Are we weak and feeble and frail and that's why we're here? I go, absolutely not. We're perfectly strong and capable of walking across fire. People do that all the time. And I go, but you have to have the consciousness to do this. And if your mind is caught up in a fear, a threat, a previous experience that traumatized you, then you're not giving the freedom of the benefit mind, the one that says, heaven on earth, this is heaven on earth. Why am I thinking all these negative things? Because the biological imperative in these people is running wild. And they're supporting it because they're not saying, okay, I got it, let go, let's go to the next thing. Why do I have to listen to this crap? That was my thing. I don't have to listen to it. I have a choice. But not until that voice came out of space somewhere and said it, did I even stop long enough to say, I do have a choice. I could go to a movie.
Yeah. And that's the power of ultimately recognizing you can make a different choice, right? You can make it.
Absolutely. And this is why your work is so important, because people have no conscious awareness of this power because they still believe that they're victims because they don't perceive themselves as creators.
Yes.
And this is quantum physics, man. Yeah. This is epigenetics.
I really want to encourage people to check out your book, which you mentioned earlier, The Biology of Belief, which I think is, as you say, a very readable introduction to a lot of these very powerful ideas. And Bruce, I really appreciate you taking the time to not just dive into this piece on sleep, but really bring it into this much bigger conversation around trauma, which is so important.
It's all interconnected, Alex, as we find out in the end. There was nothing that was a separate entity all by itself out there. And so let's weave a better story. And you're really so important in your efforts, because everyone that you touch in this regard can free up their life and be a creator instead of a victim. And I can tell you from my perspective, I love my life because why? I've learned to be the creator and to put that woman down at the other end of the river, let her down and move on to the next thing. And if you don't put that person down, then you're carrying that person wherever you go. And that's the trauma.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.